Okay, so the goal for today is to finish the Ezra of Ezra and Nehemiah, and finish the story here. We're going to meet Ezra again later on in Nehemiah. He'll come back, which makes it complicated figuring out, you know, the chronology of Ezra to Nehemiah. Does Nehemiah come after Ezra? Are they overlapping? There's a lot of work to be done there, and we'll touch on parts of it as we go through Nehemiah. But our goal today is to finish Ezra. And so Ezra has been dealing for the past couple of weeks with this problem of rampant intermarriage in his community. Right? He goes to Israel, he finds everyone in Israel is intermarrying. Could be they were intermarrying even before, but they are still in Israel intermarrying. Maybe they're intermarrying worse than they were before. And Ezra's very perturbed by this. And so in Perek Tet, he basically has a ta'anit, a fast, and he davens. Sort of takes responsibility for this problem. But he doesn't actually propose any solutions. And we noted at the beginning of Perek Yud, at the end of our last class, that Ezra doesn't actually come up with the solution here, but rather Shechaniah, who seems perhaps to be one of the, you know, a leader in the community, but not necessarily someone of great prominence, we saw a debate about that, comes up with the idea of, okay, you know, we've done bad, so the way to solve this problem is to send away all of our foreign wives. Right? And it's unclear whether Shechaniah himself participated in intermarried. It seems like he didn't. He's not mentioned in the list later on in the parak. And he puts forward the suggestion and says, Ezra, you know, chazak va'aseh, you should get on board and you should do this. And we discussed last time, first of all, whether Shechaniah is a prominent person or not. On the one hand, we saw that he might be among the lists of Ezra's aliyah, who brought a very large contingent up with him. So it could be that he's a significant figure. On the other hand, Rav Meidan, in source number 4, suggested that maybe Shechaniah is not so prominent, and in fact, he's just sort of a blue-collar person, a normal member of the community who's inspired by Ezra to take action. And we see some parallels between that and Pinchas, again, where someone who's not officially a leader takes action and tries to solve a problem. We also discussed briefly, that this was at the very end of last class, why this was a solution as opposed to another, perhaps more obvious solution, which is if you have people who have intermarried, you can convert the foreign wives, and they'll be Jews, and then you don't have to send them away. And so we saw a debate.
What about their children?
So you can convert the children too. We have a halacha called Ger Katan, so it's totally an option if we wanted to use it. But apparently we did not want to use it, and we saw a couple of reasons for that at the end of last time. The Ibn Ezra said, they just weren't going to be great converts, right? We know what a good convert is. A good convert is someone who is sincere, who's, you know, truly committed, who will, you know, adopt Jewish identity fully and adopt commitment to God fully. Ibn Ezra says, we don't have those kinds of converts. They were not converts like Roots, right? Roots, a paradigmatic good convert. You know, Amecha mi alokai echa alokai, I'm totally committing to Naomi. We don't have that. Rav Meinan suggested on a more sort of pragmatic level that it's easier to accept converts when you yourself have a strong national identity, a strong religious identity. In a society where a lot of people are rampantly intermarrying and you don't really have a strong religious core in the community, so adding a bunch of foreigners is going to, you know, dilute what's there already. So, you know, under normal circumstances, you could absorb them and bring up the converts, and they could bring up the community. But if so many people in the community are foreign, you know, idolaters, it's going to be very difficult, which was another interesting kind of svara. There's one more detail just to figure out here, and we alluded to this already back in Perek Tet, which is why specifically send away the foreign women and not send away the foreign men, right? Was intermarriage only one directional? Or is there some other reason why we wouldn't necessarily care about this so much? And there are a couple possibilities here. It could be that intermarriage, a Jewish man marrying a non-Jewish woman, is more severe because we hold, at least at this point, in matrilineal descent. Right? Ramban al Torah, you know, cites a view that maybe before Matan Torah we didn't hold the matrilineal descent and it only came as part of the Torah. Okay, we can have that debate there, but it's not so directly relevant for us. But if we hold a matrilineal descent, so marrying foreign women is a much bigger deal. Foreign men, it's in Avera, but at least the kids are going to be Jewish, and it doesn't have the same effect on, you know, weakening the yichus, weakening the strength of the community. Abar Benel, we saw earlier, suggested that there was no intermarriage the other direction. You know, no nice Jewish girl would bring home a not Jewish man. And that's Abar Benel's idea. We saw it already. We're not going to flesh it out. But Rabbi Bernal has that idea that that was the case. But some of the other commentaries actually assume there was intermarriage in both directions. Metzudat David says it explicitly, and we'll see in Pesukim later on in the parak. Metzudat David says that you should separate from the Amei Haaretz, Livli Teit Bibnotechem Le'ovdei Kochavim, not to give your daughters to the male non-Jews. So other Rishonim assume there was intermarriage in both directions. So according to them, why is it the emphasis of the parak on sending away the foreign women? So we have one answer, which is to say, the Abar Bernal's answer, it was only happening one directionally. Another answer is to say, it's less severe because of matrilineal descent, so it's not as big a deal, and you have to solve the most important problem first. A third possibility, which is suggested by the Da'am Yekra in source 12, also in source number 11, from Professor Shaya Cohen, I saw this, I think, Sarah Torchiner's Shiurim, is that maybe Ezra doesn't have the authority to do this. Just on a pragmatic level. It's not going to work. Because what happens when two members of different nations marry? They're going to live with one of the nations. So if a non-Jewish woman marries a Jewish man, so they'll live in Judea and Jewish society. Well, then Ezra, who runs Jewish society, has some authority to send them away. But the Jewish women who married non-Jewish men, they're out living in Edom or among the Kutim or whatever other nation that they're dealing with. And Ezra doesn't really have the authority to address that problem. He would love, of course, to bring back the Jewish women, but it's not within his domain necessarily. And so that's why he doesn't really emphasize it quite as much. One more possibility, if we want to flesh it out, is just to say maybe Ezra actually does, and he's only emphasizing one side, you know, for certain rhetorical purposes. But in fact, later on, he's going to try to, you know, play both sides of the coin. But in any case, we definitely see the emphasis is on sending away the foreign wives, and that's how the, you know, parak mostly structures itself. There's going to be a list later on in the parak of all of the foreign women all the men who sent away their foreign wives, but not a parallel list of all the women who sent away their foreign husbands. Seemingly, that's definitely not the emphasis, if it even was happening at all. Okay, so that's the plan. That's Shechaniah's idea. Let's rally the troops, send away all the foreign women. Chazak va'aseh, he ends with, because Shechaniah is emphasizing to Ezra, you actually have to do this, right? I can't actually intervene and make this happen without you. We're going to support you, he says in Pasuk Dalet, but you have to actually be the one to lead this process, even though we'll be behind you. And so that's what Ezra does. Starting in Pasuk Hay over here in source number 13. And this is Ezra's pitch, so to speak, to the people. Vayakom Ezra. Vayashba etzarei ha-kohanim ha-leviim v'chol Yisrael la'asut kadavar hazeh v'yishaveyu. So Ezra said, if you're going to be on board with this, you're going to make a shvua, you're going to take an oath to that effect. We already saw that... let's take a frame it as a question. Right? Why make them swear an oath to agree to this policy? Just implement the policy. So we have two possibilities, right? One possibility is to say that it's for emphasis, right? It's very nice to have a meeting with, you know, a bunch of members of the community. Like, what would we like to do? But until you really sort of put your money where your mouth is and actually make a real commitment, we're worried that you might not actually be committed. So come, you know, you make an oath, and I'll know that you're on my side, and then we'll go solve this problem together. But you won't buy in, right? You can't just vague conversation and vague promises aren't quite enough. The other possibility is what we saw from Malbim last time, is that by taking an oath, by having the leaders of the community take an oath, that gives Ezra more authority in dealing with this matter, right? We saw that Ezra was given a lot of authority from Artaxasta at the beginning. He was given a pretty broad mandate. But halakhically speaking, in order to have the authority to penalize in whatever way he wants these people who've intermarried, he needs a broader communal authority. There's a halachic term for this. It's called the din melech, says the Malbim, that a king has certain extrajudicial authorities that technically, halachically, don't really exist, but as part of being the leadership of a community, you're able to do certain things. And so Ezra wants to be able to marshal that authority. He needs to have everyone take an oath to that effect. So that's another possibility for why the need for the oath. So then once he has everyone on board, Vayakam Ezra milifnei beit ha'elokim. Ezra gets it from the mikdash. Remember, he's in a fairly public location, right? Maybe that's deliberate. He wants his tefillah, his tshuva, to be seen in somewhat of a more public light. Could very well be. Vayelech alishkat Yehochanan ben Eliashiv. He goes to the house or the chamber of Yehochanan ben Eliashiv. It's not exactly clear who that is. He's not necessarily played up as such a significant figure. He seems to be related to the family of the Kohen Gadol. So the Dan Mikra, if you follow the family trees in different places, but he's not necessarily. It's hard to tell, I guess, how prominent he is. Though he certainly is an ally of Ezra. So he goes to that house, but he's still fasting. He goes there. He did not eat bread or food, maybe, and he did not drink water. He was mourning over the betrayal of this community. And that was how it was framed last time in his tefillah, was a betrayal of God's covenant, so to speak. That language seem familiar to you? Lechem lo achalu mayim lo shata? Who else in Chumash? I'll give a hint. Who else in Chumash does not eat bread or drink wine at some point? Who? A nazir? No, he could eat and drink, he just can't eat, drink wine or eat grapes.
Right.
It might remind you, and we'll see this in a little bit, of Moshe Rabbeinu.
Oh.
Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Har Sinai, lechem lo achalti, mayim lo shati, right? For 40 days, he doesn't eat and drink.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting phrase, right? Maybe this reminds us of some of the, we saw this at the beginning of meeting Ezra, that there's a connection to Moshe Rabbeinu. In terms of being a Torah spiritual leader and so on. And there's going to be more there as well. So we'll come back to that. They made an announcement to everybody. Let's gather all the people to get together and have a ceremony to this effect. Right, remember before, we had all of the men, women, and children who all came to see Ezra, which also is significant, very public kind of thing. And again, it's being doubled down. Now we're going to gather even more people together to Yerushalayim. Kol b'nei ha-gola, everyone's there. V'chol sher lo yavol l'shloshet ha-yamim, katat ha-sarim v'hazikinim, anyone who doesn't come within 3 days, in accordance with the officers and the elders, yacharam kol rechusho, v'hu yibadel mikal ha-gola. Two consequences. Number one, all of his property will be yacharam, right? Confiscated, right? Chirim might also refer to giving it to the mikdash. There's certain times when that term has a sort of, sanctity associated with it. But it's going to be confiscated. It's going to be taken away. And he'll be, excised from the community. I don't know if this is a reference to karet in a spiritual sense or in a practical sense. You'll be put in chirim. Your property will be put in chirim. We'll take it. And you'll be put in chirim. You'll be outside of the community. And then you'll have to be brought back in or forgiven at some point. So both pretty significant consequences. Now maybe you understand why Ezra needs to get the official authority of the community to implement these punishments, right? By the Atzat Hasarim B'Hazkenim, if it was just Atzat Ezra, it wouldn't work. You need specifically the advice and the authority of the elders of the community to make a judgment like that. This, by the way, is also a reference to a halacha, which is referenced, we won't bother with reading the sources inside, but in sources 14 and 15, we have a reference to this, specifically the nature of this judicial authority. Malbim says it's based on the Shavua from before. The Gemara says it's more basic. We have a halacha called Hefker Beit Din Hefker, that a Beit Din has the authority basically to allocate property. Right, so in theory, and what counts as a Beit Din? It doesn't literally just mean a Beit Din. It seems to mean, any representative authority of the community. So that might give authority for taxation. That might be one purpose that you could use Hefker Beit Din Hefker for. Another one, this is an interesting one, because Purim's coming up. This will be the Purim connection for today. I was giving a shiur on some of the interesting minhagim that you find attested in different sources on Purim. And one minhag you see is that apparently certain minor thievery was permitted on Purim in some communities. I'll steal your phone, I'll steal your bag, your Mishloach Manos, and as long as you don't go too far, say some of these sources, the Ramah brings this down in the Shulchan Aruch, Ashkenazim maybe have what to rely on, Mishnah Berurah says not to do it. But in theory, the Ramah says that if you steal, it's going to be okay. And a very strong basis for this is the principle of Hefker Beit and Hefker. We all made a deal, the community, our communal authorities decided that on Purim, these kinds of minor, thefts aren't really so significant, and so we're not going to be so makbet on them on Purim.
Not quite. Like when they were leaving Egypt and they were to take the stuff.
Right, so that, I mean, that's God telling us to do so, right? So that changed, you know, a little bit different. God never told us to steal on Purim, but it's quite an interesting minhag also, like why there'd be a minhag of stealing on Purim. Again, not really, you know, halacha lemaisa, ask your local Orthodox posek, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend this. But it's a reflection of this halacha of, you give the people have the authority to decide where money goes. And so we decided that if you don't come to this convocation in 3 days, you're not going to be, your property is going to be confiscated. And so people listen. They came in 3 days. 3 days, obviously, as we know, is a very symbolic sort of time. It also implies that people aren't living so far away because they're able to hear word and come within 3 days. So no one's living so far from Yerushalayim that it wouldn't be possible to get there within 3 days. It was the 20th of the 9th month, which is Kislev. So it's right around Hanukkah time. We'll see that that's actually relevant. The weather is going to be a little bit relevant. They were in the rechov of the Beit HaElokim. So, probably doesn't mean the street. It probably means there's some like broad plaza area near the Mikdash that everyone gathered together in that place. And they were mar'idim. They were quaking because of this and because of the rain. Because Yerushalayim in the winter can get rainy sometimes. It's not always the best weather. It's interesting. Intermarriage, the weather. Now it's like an interesting juxtaposition, and that will become, again, like narratively relevant in terms of how they respond to what Ezra's trying to do. So they're concerned about the weather. But Ezra gets up there. Vayakam Ezra HaKohen, Vayomer Aleihem, Atem Ma'altem, Vatoshivo Nashim Rachriyot, you've betrayed God, you've taken foreign wives, Lo Sif Al Hashmat Yisrael, to add to the guilt of Am Yisrael, right? We're already guilty, we were in exile for 70 years, and we've come back, but only in a sort of half-hearted sort of way. We're not doing great, and now you're going to add to that sin by adding foreign wives. So that was a lot of Ezra's tefillah, was talking about, Hashem's done so much for us, we've betrayed him so many times, and we're going to keep adding sins? It's terrible. And so we have to solve this problem. Va'ata, now, tenu todah la'Hashem Elokei Avoteichem, you should give todah. Todah doesn't mean thanks here, it means confession. The same shoresh there. You could, or really acknowledgement probably is the best term, but it could be positive. You give positive acknowledgement of what Hashem's done for you, or negative acknowledgement. You acknowledge what you've done. So give todah. Be bodek, admit what you've done. Va'asuvah, so no, do what God wants. Separate from the Ameh Ha'aretz, umin ha'nashim ha'nachriyot. So this is where the Metzudah David before said, nashim ha'nachriyot is the foreign wives, Ameh Ha'aretz is the foreign husbands. That's what he wants to say. It could just be Ameh Ha'aretz is a general idea. Separate from foreign society generally, and in particular from being married to foreign wives. That's another kind of pshat you can have in the pasuk, which might be, which might work as well. So both are possibilities. And I think it works very well if you want to say that the idea of the prohibition of intermarriage is because of being, drawn after foreign societies. So separate from those foreign societies by separating from the Nashim HaNachriyot is a perfectly sensible way to read this pasuk, I think. Good, so that's Ezra's pitch to the people. Right, now we've noticed a couple interesting things. We've noticed some Moshe references, maybe Har Sinai references. We'll come back to those. And we've noticed that the people are here. They've all come, but they're bothered by different things. So let's see how the people respond. We'll jump to source 16. 14 and 15 just articulate the authority by which Ezra made the punishments that he wanted to leverage. So here's the response of the people. Ve'anu chol ha'kahal ve'yomru kol gadol. The people gathered together and they said in a loud voice, Cain, Kidvarecha aleinu la'asot. We're going to do what you said. Naseh v'nishma, right? Ooh, really? It's in a loud voice. They say it together. Very, very interesting, right? So that's going to... That fits more of these Har Sinai, Moshe kinds of parallels. But not so fast, right? We're really on board. Except we're not really on board. Aval ha'amrav, there are so many people. Meaning it's going to be very difficult to do this in a moment, right? There are a lot of people who have intermarried. We'll see if it actually is a lot of people or not. But they say a lot of people intermarried. And it's the rainy season. Ve'in koach la'amod b'chutz. We're not able to stand here. We can't just, you have the whole nation gathered together, right? We're dealing with thousands and thousands of people, right? Even if you want to be, to limit the number of people who've come just to the aliyot that we've actually done the math on and figured out how many people have come, we're still dealing with tens of thousands of people who have come since Koresh originally, you know, some decades ago. Tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people at this point. We're not going to be able to do this all in a moment, and we can't all hang out here around the Beit HaMikdash until we finish. It's not one day's work, it's not 2 days' work. We've done so many sins here, it's not going to be a small project. So don't make us do this immediately. Rather, here's a solution. And we could assess whether we think they're being really sincere and earnest, or whether they're kind of trying to brush off Ezra's Musar. It's not 100% clear. But here's what they want to propose. Ya'amdu nasarenu, appoint officers, l'chol ha'kahal, for the whole community, v'chol asher ba'arenu, for all everyone in our cities, ha'oshiv nashim nachriyot, yavol le'itim mezumanim. So let's schedule times. We're going to have divorce parties, you know, periodically. We'll invite everyone together. Lav dafka parties, I'm just, you know, using the term. But we're going to, you know, we're all going to be summoned, you know, maybe we'll summon one city at a time, and everyone who's married a foreign woman from that city is going to come at that time. So each city's elders and their judges are going to come with them. Until we have finished removing God's wrath from us, until we've finished dealing with this matter. So in other words, we're not going to deal with this all now. You have to let everyone return home, and we're going to schedule this. So the people who live in Rehovot are going to come, and the people who live in, in Yerushalayim will come, and they'll just go city by city and deal with it in that way. Could be they're trying to, you know, brush off the problem. Could be they're just dealing with the administrative reality, right? You want to be inspired by a momentary inspiration, but it's not going to work. Right, you really have to be organized about this. And there could be other reasons to want to be organized about this. I think the Dat Mikra tried to make the claim. No, it wasn't the Dat Mikra. I'm forgetting where I saw this claim in the first place. That part of the goal is if you just want to keep, you know, effective records of everything. Ezra's the Mr. Yichus. He wants to keep track of everything. Even just, you know, setting up the administrative bureaucracy to make sure this is all being done properly will take some time. It's not just a one-moment thing. Right? So I think that seems to be the impulse. Then there's this sort of cryptic pasuk. You'll tell me what you think of this also, but the Mefarshim will debate it. Ach Yonatan ben Asael, v'yachazya ben Tikva, amdu alzot. Yochanan ben Asael, but, I'll translate Ach in a sort of vague way, but Yonatan ben Asael and Yachazya ben Tikva stood up about, on this, we'll say on this, Meshulam v'Shabtai HaLevi azarum, and Meshulam and Shabtai the Levi helped them. It's a bit cryptic. What do these people do? Also mentioned the word tikva. We saw, you know, mikva, right? Hope was mentioned earlier. There's a little reference to tikva as well, but it could just be his name. I don't want to make more of it than it is. So the commentaries debate in sources 17 through 19 whether these were people who stood up in particular to help or in particular to harm and hinder this matter. The controversial. So the Midrash here, Shmot Rabbah, source number 17, it quotes an example of, you know, in describing, and this was it would have been great to get to this last week, Parsha Pekudei. It says, you know, the Pasuk in Pekudei describes how Bezalel made the Mishkan. Did Bezalel make the whole Mishkan? No, obviously there were many craftsmen, but he was the one who really, you know, dedicated himself fully, and Natan Nafsho Alav, he really, you know, dedicated himself to it. So too, Yonatan ben Asael and Yechazia ben Tikva and these people, they particularly dedicated themselves. Yonatan in particular came to deal with this, right? So there were lots of officers. These were the ones who were particularly enthusiastic about this project. That could be. On the reverse end, the Dat Mikra, Professor Zerkavod, suggests that no, these were the only ones who were particularly enthusiastic, and the other officers, they just left, right? The idea was, according to Professor Zerkavod, that the officers would stay in the city, and all the sort of Hamon Am, they would all return back to their homes and then, you know, come periodically, but the officers would stay and deal with this. And he says, well, only these officers actually did. The rest of the officers all went home with their communities. So,
doesn't it say in 16 that those three were against it? Isn't it saying they stood up for it?
The danger of not giving a translation when I present the psukim is that you're going to be a little bit biased by the translation. The translation thinks these were the opponents. Right? Malbim says that also. Malbim says, Shalom amdu neged ze lekanter ala davar rakshne ele. These were the only two who opposed this. Right, so let the record show that everyone was on board except for these people, and they are canonized in Tanakh as the opponents of stopping intermarriage. Now, we mentioned that it seems like even some of the leaders were involved in intermarriage back in the beginning of Perek Tet, right? So maybe these are people who, they have their, you know, skin in the game, and they want to keep their wives, or they're just supportive of their friends who want to keep their wives, and they don't want to participate. So one of the dangers, amdu al zot is very difficult. You stand up on this. You can stand up against it, or you can stand up for it. So it's not so simple and clear how to understand it.
So how are we going to interpret this?
It's a good question. Like I said, it's a machloket, right? Malbim says these were the only opponents, and the Dan Mikra says these were, you know, the only people who were really fully committed. How do you deal with a machloket and parshanut? It's hard to know. It's just grammatically and syntactically very difficult. Especially, I would say, you know, especially because the whole Kahal says, you know, we're going to do it, but we're not going to do it right now. So if you understand them to be very sincere, so then it seems like we're drawing a contrast, right? So if the people are very sincere, then Yonatan, but these people, they were not really so sincere. They didn't want to get involved. If we assume that the people are trying to like brush off and like let's push this off till later and not deal with it right now, then, but these leaders, they were the ones who were insistent on making it happen at the moment. So it's all about, you know, how we'll understand these individuals will probably depend on how we understand everyone else. And are they just trying to, you know, delay, or are they really sincere and enthusiastic? In any case, the people get what they want. Right? Pasuk Ted Zion, Ve'asu kin b'nei ha-gola. That's what they did. They did what they said they were going to do. Vayabadlu Ezra ha-kohen, anashim roshei ha-avot le-beit avotam, v'kulam b'shemot. Ezra separated the leaders of the people, the Roshei HaAvot, the leaders of each family, the Hulam B'Shemot, you know, everyone by name, right? We're setting up a bureaucracy here. Bureaucracy is a bad connotation, but here it's just a bureaucracy that you need to get a job done. The Yeshvu B'Yom Echad L'Chodesh Asiri, they gathered together on the first day of Tevet, right? So this was, you know, the 20th of Kislev. So, all right, let's set up the bureaucracy, and the first day of Tevet, we're going to start working on actually dealing with this problem, right? There's a good messer here just for, if you want to set up, solve problems, sometimes it helps to set up the system, put a few people in charge, set up an organization, don't just dive in head first and try to make things happen. You really need to set up a program. And what do they do? Lidar yosh bat hadavar, to examine this matter. It's like lidrosh hadavar, to examine it and to deal with the problem. And vayichalu b'chol ha'nashim ha'oshivu nashim nachriyot ad yom echad l'chodesh ha'rishon. So this was the first day of Tevet. 3 months later, on the first day of the first month, that is to say, on the first day of Nisan, as we know, a very symbolic date, it's when Ezra, you know, starts planning his first aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. So that's when they finished dealing with this. So it was a three-month project. You set up an administration. Over 3 months, you solve the problem, and you move on. Excellent. So, you know, whether the people really intended or not to kind of brush off Ezra, at the end of the day, it seems to work. And in fact, the continuation of the Perek for, 25 psukim or so, starting in source 20, is to, list all of the people who separated from their foreign wives. It's great. So we're not, we should read through the list. There are a couple of names that are particularly significant, just in terms of understanding some of the story a little bit better. But this is a list of all of the people who had married foreign women. Vayimtzei mibnei ha-kohanim asher hoshivu nashim nachriyot. Ibn Yeshua ben Yotzadak ve'achav, Maaseya ve'Eliezer ve'Arav ve'Ugdalia. I put that pasuk in bold because who is Yeshua ben Yotzadak? He's a Kohen Gadol. Yeshua Kohen HaGadol. I think he came up earlier in Ezra, comes up in Zechariah. So, you know, this is permeating all levels of society, right? And we'll see again, as intermarriage remains a problem through Nehemiah, we'll see it continue. Vayinu Yadam lo'tzina Shehem. But they, you know, dedicated themselves to giving up their foreign wives. And they brought korbanot asham, which are guilt offerings. They're like sin offerings. They're a little bit different. For their sin. We'll talk about the korbanot in a little bit, but let's just kind of go through this list. I love these lists. Someone should name their kid after people on this list and try to... these are people who married foreign women, but they were chozer b'tshuva. So, you know, maybe these are people who are really very beautiful models. You know, you don't meet that many Yozavads, but wouldn't it be a great name? You know, you can really compare this list to all the earlier lists and see of the people who came, who were intermarried, who didn't, and there were Leviim on the list, and there were Mishorim on the list, and so on and so forth. In the interest of time, we'll skip reading the whole list, but it really is just a list of a lot of very interesting Jewish names. I encourage everyone just to get some exposure to what historic Jewish names have been. I also put the Pasuk Chavav in bold because Yechiel of the Bnei Elam is another person who intermarried. And whose idea was separated from the foreign woman? Shechanya ben Yechaziel. Yechiel. I apologize.
Yeah, then Shechanya, he went along with it, you know, but he didn't marry a foreign wife, but he went along with it so that the people wouldn't be embarrassed.
Right, so that was the Gemara in Sanhedrin we saw last time, that, you know, he embodied good traits. Right. It could be, so that's the Gemara. And is that inconsistent to say that he sort of blamed himself? Like, we have all married foreign women. I didn't marry a foreign wife, but we as a community have. And at the same time, to note that, well, if Shechaniah ben Yechiel from Bnei Elam is concerned about this, and then on the list we have Yechiel mi Bnei Elam, it could be he's got skin in the game.
Yeah.
Right? He's a young, passionate person. He knows his father's married a foreign woman, and he wants to address that problem. So that's also a kind of interesting note in terms of people's religious motivations. Anyway, so he goes on, finishing up the list. Shalom Amaria Yosef, Mirei Nevo Ye'il, Matatiah, Zavad Zvina, Yoel Benaya. Don't think Matatiahu is only a name in Hanukkah. He's already in Tanakh, Matatiah. V'Yoel Benaya, Kol Eile, Nas'u Nashim Rachriyot. They all married foreign wives. V'yish Mehem Nashim. And they had some of them had wives who from whom they had children. Yasimu banim, maybe they placed children. It's an interesting idiom. So a couple of things just to highlight about this section, right? So again, it's a whole list of names. You could do the work of comparing all these names to all the lists that came before. But a couple of pieces of notes. Number one, these are korbanot asham. So that's quite interesting, right? Pretty much every time we've had a set of korbanot now, we've had to step back and say, like, were these korbanot appropriate? It seems to be breaking the normal rules of korbanot, etc. So there are a couple of interesting possibilities here, right? So normally, first of all, you don't bring a korban normally on a sin done b'bezid, intentionally. There are some exceptions, but most korbanot that you bring are for unintentional sins, like a korban chatat, that's always on unintentional sins. And even asham is mostly... Asham is usually even... let's take a step back. There are two kinds of korban asham. This is a bit of background to the world of korbanot. We're getting to Vayikra. It's very appropriate. So there's one kind of korban asham called asham talui. Asham talui is when you're not sure if you did something that's worthy of a korban chata, so you bring this korban asham instead, kind of covering your bases. You know you might have, you're not sure if you did. Then there's what's called asham vadai. You get an asham vadai for five different kinds of sins, and those are the... As far as I know, the only example of korbanot that you bring on sins done intentionally. And there are five particular sins. It's very unique that there's these five, and they're all kind of interesting examples, right? It's not like avodah zarah is on the list. It's about all kinds of interesting kinds of sins. And the Gemara in Kritut, in source number 21, says, that's what happened here. All of these people who brought korbanot were all bringing an asham vadai because they had all not just married foreign women, which, as we saw as a machloket, is it a rabbinic or biblical prohibition? But they even married shifchot charufot, which refers to a very particular case, according to the Gemara. There's a machloket about what it means, but typically we understand that a shifcha charufa is a woman who is half free and half a shifcha, half an eved. So imagine a case where, you know, an eved is owned by, you know, they sort of, two people split the cost of a shifcha, and then one of them frees her. So now she's half free woman, half maidservant, and so that's a Shivcha Charuva. That's very implausible to say that everyone who's separated from their foreign wives all married these very particular rare cases of Shivcha Charuva. That would be very unusual. But that's the possibility the Gemara says to explain why they would bring a Korban Asham, because otherwise you're not really supposed to bring a Korban Asham on this sort of sin. That's one possibility. Rashi says, it's a Racha. Right? That's the trump card where you get to say, we're allowed to break the rules for a one-time exemption, where an authorized Navi or an authorized authority is able to say, we're going to break the normal rules. You can't normally bring an Asham for this, but we're going to let you for whatever reason. Right? And that's something that, it's a real thing, Horat Shah does exist. It's not something that we usually employ in normal halachic life, but, you know, Nevi'im certainly, and if we assume that Ezra was a Navi, you know, is identify him with Malachi or one of the other Nevi'im, you know, there's more leeway for a Horat Shah. And the Da'at Mikra makes the interesting point, which is that maybe we should consider them, right, so if they're done b'mezid, it's very hard to imagine bringing a korban. The Da'at Mikra says maybe we should consider them to be shogegim, we should consider them to be negligent sinners and not intentional sinners. Why? Because Da'at Mikra is consistent with what he said before. Why did they intermarry? Because they thought that the prohibition of intermarriage didn't apply to women from nations that were not the seven Canaanite nations. And so, Ezra told them, you're wrong, this actually is a biblical prohibition, but they thought that, no, it's only these particular nations, so they have to listen to Ezra's authority, but we're not going to judge them as harshly as we might have otherwise. It was a, you know, perhaps a legitimate halachic disagreement or a legitimate halachic misunderstanding, and not something they necessarily were meant to have known. That's an interesting kind of possibility as well. And again, once it becomes negligent or unintentional, the room to bring a korban becomes a little bit more possible or prevalent. That's one issue that you get into the names, just figuring out the question of the korban. One last issue with the names. This is the more prevalent, more relevant one. Right? If you count up all the names of everyone who separated from the foreign wives, I think the number is 113. You get. You do the math. You can check it. Now, is that a lot or a little?
It's a lot compared to how many, you know, went back to Israel from Babel.
I mean, if it's 100 people out of, let's say there are 100,000 now. Seems like a rough estimate that might be more or less appropriate. Well, you had, with Zerubbabel, you had, you know, 40, you had around 50,000. 40-something thousand. Ezra comes up with another several thousand, and it's been several decades, the population's grown. So, you know, less 0.1%, that's not terrible, right? And just the absolute number is not so great, right? You know, when 100 people do something wrong, I mean, it depends on the size of your community, but, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think of this as a tremendous breach, right? And everyone, you know, not everyone, but most of the commentaries seem to assume this is a pretty small number, right? Now, we've been presenting this as a big betrayal, a me'ilah. We've called this chit rav, ashemim. We use this really strong language. And yet, you do the math, it's only 113 people. So how do you explain this? I actually want to double check that Da'at Mikra will do the math for me and confirm that it's exactly that number, but I think I'm right about that. Me'a u'shoses agvarim. There we go. Right? Out of the Yeshuv, he says, of tens of thousands of men. So Malbim, source 24, says, yeah, it really wasn't such a tremendously long list. But nonetheless, when a sin like this is done, it is a chit klali, it is a communal sin. But Asher Nasa Bifarhesia is done publicly. Vaserim lo michu bedavar, and the leaders didn't object to it. And moreover, the leaders participated in it. So that's what we call a big sin. A small number of people, but a sin done in public view with no objection, that's a breach of values. If 100 people do a private sin, okay, so it's 100 people's individual problem. If it's done in public, then we've all failed to censure this behavior enough to make people not want to do it. That's one possibility. It's a small number of people, but it's a really big sin because of the implications. The Da'at Mikra goes the other way. The Da'at Mikra, source 25, says no. Ezra actually failed. Well, not failed, but he didn't succeed as much as he hoped. There were probably many hundreds of people who intermarried, and Ezra only managed to solve the problem for 113. We find that Ezra did not really fulfill his mission fully. Nehemiah is going to be a more forceful leader than Ezra. We've already alluded to this on a number of occasions. And so if Nehemiah is going to really solve the problem, Ezra's trying to use, you know, the spiritual, religious authority, his moral authority to solve the problem. Until Ezra comes and says, we are going to force you to get rid of your wives, it's not going to happen. And so, at this point, according to that mikra, we're sort of in an in-between state. Right over there. I don't know if anyone's in the office, though. Yes, anyway, sorry for the interruption. So Damocrates thinks this was really not a failure, but an incomplete success, right? Again, it's one of those cases where you have a long list. So on the one hand, that highlights the significance of everyone who did the right thing. But also, if everyone's countable, you know, you're probably not getting everyone, right? We don't name every single person who left Mitzrayim, because there were 600,000 people. You can't do it. You could count all the 113 people here. Obviously, it was not as impactful. So that leaves us with perhaps an impression, at least according to the Dan Mikra, that maybe this was not a totally successful solution. It was the first step to a solution, and we'll see that that Nehemiah is going to come and be a little bit more successful as time goes on. I think just in the interest of finishing the parak, we'll try to make a couple of last points. I'm trying to finish Ezra, and then we'll pick up with Nehemiah hopefully next week. So let's sort of assess Ezra's rule overall, right? There are some indications in the story that things are going really well. Ezra gets a plan, inspires the people, gets them to do what he wants, and separates 100 families, and maybe that's a large number relative to the community. We have no real idea. On the other hand, we have various kinds of hesitation, right? Ezra waits for other people to take the leadership. Even after he agrees to their plan, he is still not the one who's actively gathering all of the leaders. I'm summarizing out of Rabbi Sinensky's analysis in source number 26. And the people agree wholeheartedly, but then say, we're not really going to do this now. We're going to delay this. Let's deal with the weather, and so on and so forth. And we end up with, again, maybe what might be a relatively small number of marriages actually resolved. So, you know, the first implication you get is that perhaps Ezra, in terms of actually getting things done as a leader, maybe is not as fully successful as he might have been. This is Rabbi Sinensky's conclusion. Whereas Nehemiah, in the last paragraph of source number 26, but you could read the whole thing, whereas Nehemiah was a forceful political personality, deeply grounded in Torah values, Ezra was first and foremost a brilliant, dedicated scholar. Right? We emphasize that about him. He's a sofer, primarily. Ezra was not, in essence, a man of action. At the end of the day, Ezra is an introvert who thrives on the solitude of the Beit Midrash. He's a religious leader. He prays. He fasts. And there are other people who try to get things done based on his inspiration. Only when prodded does Ezra rise to the occasion and move mountains to profoundly shape his community. So he does make an impact, but the impact that a Yoshev Beit Midrash is going to have is going to be very different than the impact of a real political a sort of personality. So that's I shouldn't call it a negative, but a particular perspective on the way that Ezra is going to work, right? Other people take the lead in action. He takes the lead in inspiration and in the religious side. And together, you make a good impact, but maybe a limited kind of impact. That's why Nehemiah still has to deal with this later on. Rav Yoel ben Nun, who's a major voice in Tanakh in Eretz Yisrael, has a different parallel take. Meaning, I don't think he would reject any of the aforementioned analysis. He's the one who coined that term that Ezra was the first chief rabbi in terms of that role. But at the same time, Ezra's, staying in the background is not a mistake, necessarily. It's a style of leadership, right? It's not a failure to be a leader. It's just a particular path. Behakravai yishit shel kvodo, cholel Ezra za'azua tziburi kazeh. Ezra doesn't use the authority he's given by Artaxasta. That's not the kind of leader he is. He's the inspirational kind of leader who inspires the people. So he, in Perek Tet, fasts and cries and gathers the whole crowd publicly around him. And he waits for someone in the community to step up. By doing so, he's empowered the community to get something done. And there are costs and benefits to it, right? If this was totally top-down, so it's forcing the community to do certain things, but you get less communal buy-in. But by being a religious role model and inspiring people like Shechaniah or people like, perhaps, who were in that pasuk, Meshulam and Shabtai and Yonathan ben Asael and Yechaziah, he inspires them to leadership. And that might be exactly a particular type of leader. Not a failure in leadership, but someone who runs things in a certain kind of way. And you wonder, right, could Nehemiah have later been successful without Ezra having come and laid the communal groundwork for setting up this value of something we care about? So, and there's something very, you know, partial about this, where Ezra's not a failed leader, but rather someone who, you know, has a certain role in terms of his leadership. There's one more concluding idea about Ezra while we're finishing up the parak, which is some of these motifs we've alluded to already, these Har Sinai, Matan Torah kinds of motifs. So we mentioned the idea of Lechem lo achal, mayim lo shata. We mentioned the idea of the Kol Gadol na'aseh v'nishma. Some of these parallels are pretty clear. What's the meaning of these parallels? And there's some other language also, right? So for example, Ezra makes a brit that we should solve this problem, a shvuah. So Rabbi Sadinsky wants to make the claim that this is part of sort of doubling down on this theme of reconstituting and renewing our covenant, our brit with Hashem. And here we go. So the only reason Moshe returns to Sinai is due to the Jews' sin of the golden calf. His return to the mountaintop comes under far from ideal circumstances. Quite the opposite. It is an attempt to achieve repentance for the Jews' transgression. Right? This is Ezra coming and saying, despite the fact that we've sinned, we're recommitting ourselves. The parallels to the revelation in Ezra, as well as in Nehemiah, we'll see Parakhat is a major parak in Nehemiah, are intended to accomplish much the same. Although the community had sinned, effectively trampling the Torah that Moshe taught at Sinai, as in the case of Moshe's return to the mountain, repentance creates the possibility of renewed covenantal commitment. The parallels to Sinai, in other words, reinforce the idea that Shivat Zion represents a time of renewed commitment to our relationship with God. The central theme of the theophany, the revelation of Hashem's presence, and Moshe's ascent to Sinai in search of atonement. And in light of this, we may fully appreciate the ubiquity of variations on the term covenant in Ezra Nehemiah. That's been a motif. We've already picked up on some of that phraseology a couple of times. Ezra makes a shvuah with the people and so on. And that's exactly the sort of the idea of renewing and restoring the covenant, right? The tshuva movement that is associated with this period. Again, Ezra Parakhet, Nehemiah Parakhet will be a lot more of those kinds of themes. But what we see in Ezra concluding in this Perek Yud is the first steps towards a mass tshuva, the first steps towards that mass renewal of a connection to Hashem, and they're baby steps, but there are steps that are meaningful and steps that maybe lay the groundwork for Nehemiah's later successes. Okay, with that, we are done. Hadron Alach, Sefer Ezra. But we're on to Sefer Nehemiah, so plenty more to do over the course of the rest of the year.